Just a quick, very quickly. Normally, we run this past the board each time I speak, about a week or so early. This time, we did not get a chance to do it. So if it sounds a little rough, it's because the board did not get a chance to give their excellent input and counsel. So any mistakes or disasters are mine alone this time around. Let's begin by asking a question. This is a question that you need to think about throughout the evening. What is the difference between plundering and destroying another nation and nation building? What's the difference? What if we called Alexander the Great a nation builder? What if we did? What if we called Stalin? How about the Caesars, the Ptolemies? Were they not nation builders? Were they not nations, or were they not people who attempted to create other nations in their image? Going back further, the Babylonians, the Assyrians. What's the difference between nation building and good old-fashioned plunder? That's the question we need to think about throughout the evening. We're going to look at Psalm 9 tonight, and I want you to notice some things. I want you to notice the extent to which David identifies with the dominion of Christ. I want you to notice the connection justice has with benefiting the poor. Also, the emphasis on nations in Psalm 9, and the two prayers that are prayed. But before we do that, a couple points here. We'll take a look at two aspects of our topic tonight. Those two aspects are, number one, God has a relationship with nations. Yes, we have been taught all our church lives, implicitly if not explicitly, that God is only concerned about individuals, never nations. How many of you have ever heard, I want to see your hands, a sermon preached on God's, in church now, on God's relationship to the nations. Okay, let's say IRBC does not count. Okay, honestly. Have you ever heard that sermon ever in your church? Ever? I mean, how can that be? Well, we'll ask that maybe later. Because we're going to look at Psalm 9 tonight, and we're going to see what God has to say about the nations. Secondly, the difference between nation building and kingdom building is the difference between love and hate, goodness and wickedness, war and peace, and one of our favorites here at the Mid-Atlantic Reformation Society, authority versus power. You can never, ever talk about society, the state, civil interaction, without making that distinction between authority and power. Properly constituted authority versus good, old-fashioned power. I got a gun, you don't. I got a uniform, you don't. First of all, this quote tonight from James Jordan, talking about kingdoms. Jesus came to set up a kingdom. And in that kingdom, the church continues to be his priestly and prophetic voice. All of life is to submit to King Jesus. Two decades ago, the sectarians, those who believe that Christ doesn't have anything to do with the nations, with kingdoms, only individuals, okay? That's what he's talking about. Two decades ago, the sectarians went to war against theonomists and Christian Reconstructionists for insisting that all Scripture, including the Mosaic Law, is profitable for instruction in all righteousness, including legal and political matters. To be sure, the theonomists often went further and claimed that the specific laws God gave to Israel as a civil society are in detail binding upon Christian nations today, not binding in a more general wisdom fashion as God's word to be creatively and applied in sometimes new ways. Okay, might have a small disagreement with him there, but he's still getting the point. But, he says, for a long time, the Christian recons were the only people insisting that the Bible be taken seriously as King Jesus' word for all of life, and it was that more general teaching that made them scandalous in the eyes of sectarians, and trust me, they still are. You insist that the Bible speaks to the civil magistrate, and suddenly you've given up the gospel, right? That's the way it is. For the sectarian, the notion of Christendom, of national and international transformation, is itself an evil for them. For them, the church is an elect community simply existing in this world and waiting for the next. Christian families and even Christian schools are acceptable as isolated from the world, but discipling the nations is rejected. King Jesus is king only of the church and individuals, not of nations. This is what we're up against, my friends. That mentality right there permeates 99% of the institutional church in North America, and I'm probably low in my percentage numbers. Let's look at Psalm 9. Let's look at what this has to say. I want to read it through first. Try to remember what you read here, and then we're going to dissect it a little bit after we read it through. To the chief musician, to the tune of Death of the Sun, interestingly enough, a particular tune that we don't have access to any longer. A psalm of David, I will praise you, O Lord, with my whole heart. I will tell of all your marvelous works. I will be glad and rejoice in you. I will sing praise to your name, O Most High. When my enemies turn back, they shall fall and perish at your presence. Remember, we're talking about four things here. The extent to which David identifies with the dominion of Christ, the connection justice has with benefiting the poor, the emphasis on nations, and the two prayers that are prayed. For you have maintained my right and my cause. You sat on the throne judging in righteousness. You have rebuked the nations. You have destroyed the wicked. You have blotted out their name forever and ever. Oh, enemy destructions are finished forever. And you have destroyed cities. Even their memory has perished. But the Lord shall endure forever. He has prepared his throne for judgment. He shall judge the world in righteousness. And he shall administer judgment for the peoples in uprightness. The Lord will also be a refuge for the oppressed, a refuge in times of trouble. And those who know your name will put their trust in you. For you, Lord, have not forsaken those who seek you. Sing praises to the Lord who dwells in Zion. Declare his deeds among the people. When he avenges blood, he remembers them. He does not forget the cry of the humble. Have mercy on me, O Lord. Consider my trouble from those who hate me. You who lift me up from the gates of death, that I may tell all your praise in the gates of the daughter of Zion, I will rejoice in your salvation. The nations have sunk down in the pit which they have made. In the net which they hid, their own foot is caught. The Lord is known by the judgment he executes. The wicked is snared in the work of his own hands. Meditation, or think about that. I hope that's a good thought to you. The wicked shall be turned into hell, and all the nations that forget God. For the needy shall not always be forgotten. The expectation of the poor shall not perish forever. And those who know your name will put their trust in you. For you, Lord, have not forsaken those who seek you. Sing praises to the Lord who dwells in Zion. Declare his deeds among the people. When he avenges blood, he remembers them. He does not forget the cry of the humble. Arise, O Lord, do not let man prevail. Let the nations be judged in your sight. Put them in fear, O Lord, that the nations may know themselves to be but men. Anybody see an address to the nations there? Anybody see any theology going back and forth between the psalmist and the nations? Maybe a little? Let's take it apart a little bit. Let's start over here. To the chief musician, to the tune of Death of the Sun, a psalm of David, I will praise you, O Lord, with my whole heart. I will tell of all your marvelous works. I'll be glad and rejoice in you. I will sing praise to your name, O Most High. When my enemies turn back, they shall fall and perish at your presence. From the first verse there, here we have two things. Intense praise. We have this, right? I will praise you, O Lord, with my whole heart. Because of, intense praise, because of marvelous works, right? Marvelous works. So, what marvelous works? Well, before we find out what the marvelous works, we read this. I will be glad and rejoice in you. I will sing praise to your name, O Most High. When my enemies turn back, they shall fall and perish at your presence. You mean to tell me David is praising God for the marvelous work of destroying David's enemies? Okay, I got a little carried away with the... But yes! Now, are we okay with this in our Sunday school class? David is praising God for the marvelous work of destroying David's enemies. But wait a minute. Let's ask ourselves before we go far. Is David talking about the guy that cut him off in the fast lane on his way to work? Not hardly. We're going to find out who his enemies are. For you have maintained my right and my cause. You sat on the throne judging in righteousness. You see how David is connecting himself here with righteousness, with the righteousness of God? He loves it. You have rebuked the nations. You have destroyed the wicked. You have blotted out their name forever and ever. Oh, enemy destructions are finished forever. You have destroyed cities. This is what the wicked have done. But they've even their memory is forgotten or perished. David's cause, notice this if you would. David's cause is God's cause, which is righteous judgment. Is that our cause? Secondly, a description of God's cause. Check it out. Three things. Nations rebuked. See what else. Wicked destroyed. You know, you're like a checklist, right? Nations rebuked. Wicked destroyed. And their memory even gone. Statement to the wicked. No more destruction. See, here he's praising God. And now he's got a statement David has for the wicked. No more destruction. He reminds them of their wickedness. And a statement that God has completed his and David's desire. No more memory of the wicked. Of course, he's looking forward to the time when we won't even remember the wicked anymore. Nations we're talking about here, my friends. We're talking about nations. But the Lord shall endure forever. Ah. Do we see a separation right here between kingdom building and nation building? You see, the nation building, they're going to perish. There will be no nations one day anymore. But the Lord shall endure forever. He has prepared his throne for judgment. What a good thing. Even better, he'll judge the world in righteousness and administer judgment for the peoples in uprightness. The Lord will also be a refuge for the oppressed, a refuge in times of trouble. But let's ask ourselves this. Who are the oppressed? Here. The oppressed are those who are being judged in something other than righteousness. My friends, when we have the wicked in seats of judgment, then it will be the righteous who will be oppressed. The righteous have two choices and two choices only when the wicked rule. Two choices. Choice number one, be oppressed, be persecuted. Choice number two, join the ranks of the wicked. No third way, my friends. They won't let us alone for long. And to those who know your name, they will put their trust in you. For you, Lord, have not forsaken those who seek you. This is the righteous again. Sing praises to the Lord who dwells in Zion. Declare his deeds among the people. When he avenges blood, this is stiff stuff. When he avenges blood, he remembers them. He does not forget the cry of the humble. Again, the humble are those who have been oppressed by the wicked. If those who know the name of Christ put their trust in him, why is this? It is because those who seek Christ are the oppressed of the previous verse. And what deeds are we talking about here? Declare his deeds. What deeds? We are talking about Christ, the avenger of blood. Let's ask. We're talking about nations here. What do we identify with when we identify the state? Generally speaking, when we talk about the state, we're talking about the laws that come down from the state, right? As a general rule. That's usually what we mean. David is praising God as a leader of nations, as the king of nations, who will judge righteously. He asks for mercy. Consider my trouble from those who hate me. Now, who are those who hate him? Those who hate him are those who judge wickedly. You who lift me up from the gates of death, that I may tell of all your praise in the gates of the daughter of Zion. Nations have sunk down in the pitch which they have made, and the net which they hid their own foot is caught. Here is David's cry. He wants to talk about it being the Lord's salvation. He wants to demonstrate that. And what does that salvation look like? Nationally speaking, it looks like nations who have sunk down in the pit which they have made. That's salvation, according to Psalm 9, in a societal sense. Moving on. The Lord is known by the judgment he executes. Think about this. The Lord is known by the judgment he executes. The wicked is snared in the work of his own hands. Think about that. And when he's saying meditation and think about that, he's not saying it's a bad thing, my friends. The wicked shall be turned into hell and all the nations that forget God. How we preach this when we go through this and we make the nations an individual here. Now, this really means the nations that, I mean, a nation doesn't go to hell as such. But the nations can certainly bring hell on earth, as we say, and death and destruction. I believe that's what that's talking about here. For the needy shall not always be forgotten. The expectation of the poor shall not perish forever. There's a day coming, David says. The wheels of justice will grind. Let me ask you this question, though, because I'm particularly interested in this. This is something to think about. The Lord is known by the judgment he executes. What are some of the ways the Lord is known? By his works and salvation and creation, it's true. We talk about knowing the Lord, right? But he is also known by his justice. Not only stated, but executed by causing the wicked to engineer their own destruction that they had in mind for the righteous. You see, we'd like to say here, in our modern sense, and we'll have time for questions later, but follow me on this. We'd like to say the Lord is known by the judgment he declares, if you will. We can sort of live with that, right? You know, he declares judgment. We have his word. We know right from wrong. Good, but that's actually not what it says, how he's known. He is known that way. But what this is saying is not by the judgment he declares, but the judgment that he executes, that he exercises. My friends, do we want the entire world to know Christ? We sure do. We absolutely do. Have you ever thought that by submitting to the judgments of Christ, that he will be known? The end of the wicked nations is hell itself. Destruction, wickedness. But when that happens, the needy and the poor are delivered. And finally, a prayer. Arise, O Lord, do not let man prevail. Let the nations be judged in your sight. Put them in fear, O Lord, that the nations may know themselves to be but men. What a wonderful prayer. You know, if all these big shots that control all this money and all this bureaucracy, and who knows what they really control, because most of the time it's some guy in a desk somewhere telling what to do, and we don't even know his name. But these dear people that think they're so great, you know what they need, David says? Some good old-fashioned fear. Fear of the Lord. And we tend to think of fear of us. You know, the voters are going to revolt. The voters are going to kick you out. They need the fear of the Lord, which we know is the beginning of wisdom. That's from Psalm chapter 9. Now, I want to show this next graphic here. And I want to demonstrate this next graphic from Genesis chapter 14. Genesis chapter 14, where we have the first recorded war in Scripture, when we have the most clear distinction between a wicked man or men who started a war and a righteous man who ended it. But let's look at this first. Nation building. And all this, I believe, I'm going to be able to get from Genesis 14. So you, those of you who are paying attention, you can hold my feet to the fire on this. If I'm making something up or if I'm really getting this. All right? Because we're going to read it. Nation building, forced service, murder, stealing, general destruction, submitting to man, plunder, hatred. Kingdom building, voluntary service, life giving versus stealing, life and giving, restoration versus destruction, submitting to God is all about the reward for the responsible, not for the powerful. You see, that's what work was supposed to be about, right? That's what working for a living was supposed to be about at one time, right? You're responsible enough to get a job and then you get paid. There's only one other way to get paid, right? Not get paid. You either work for what you get or you steal it. No third way. Reward for the responsible and actually loving your neighbor. Now, let's go to Genesis chapter 14 and Abram. Now the Lord said, I'm sorry, let's start here. And it came to pass in the days of Aramphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Eleazar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of nations, interesting name, that they made war with Bera, king of Sodom, Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, Shemember, I love that name, Shemeber, like Meber, Shemeber, all right, Shemeber, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar, all these joined together in the valley of Siddim, that is the Salt Sea. 12 years they served Chedorlaomer, and in the 13th year they rebelled. So here we already have a little bit of forced service and plunder going on. Okay? 12 years, 13th year they'd had enough and said, no, we're not going to do this anymore. Okay? In the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him came and attacked the Rephaim in Ashtaroth, Carnaim, and Zuzim in Ham, and Emim in Shaveth Kiriathim, and the Horites in their mountains of Seir as far as El Paran, which is by the wilderness. Then they turned back and came to Enmishpat, that is Kadesh, and attacked all the country of the Amalekites and the Amorites who dwelt there. So it appears as if they came and they made war with these other guys. It's four guys making war with five, basically. We'll see here in a minute. And then they kind of like on their way back, I don't know, when you got the war paint on, right? You're doing the killing and the plundering.
What the heck?
Yeah. Why not? I mean, whoever heard of like, you know, principle and that kind of stuff? Hey, look, let's see. We have weapons. They don't. They have stuff. We want. Pretty easy conclusion. So we got the plunder all going on here. And we've got already had the forced service going on. Okay? Now, let's keep going. And the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela went out and joined together in battle in the valley of Siddim against Chedorlaomer and those other four guys we mentioned, three other guys we mentioned earlier. Now, the valley of Siddim was full of asphalt pits, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled. Some fell there, and the remainder fled to the mountains. Then they took all the goods, these are the winners now, of Sodom and Gomorrah. Got the plunder here going. And the general destruction, we've already seen that. Okay, they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their provisions and went their way. They also took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. So now we've got the stealing here, the man stealing and the hatred for your neighbor. Then one who escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew, for he dwelt by the terebinth trees of Mamre, the Amorite, the brother of Eshcol and brother of Aner, and they were allies with Abram. Now when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his 318 trained servants who were born in his house and went in pursuit as far as Dan. Now these 318 trained servants, it says they were born in his house. They were raised up by Abram. Do you think these guys were like, like lined up for the draft? Like Abram said, okay, all right, we're going to line up here, and we're going to count by threes. Everybody who gets the number three is going out to fight. Not the way these guys operated. No way. You see, they're serving voluntarily is what they're doing. They're born in his house. They're his servants. And they've served Abraham his whole life. And the way these guys fight, they're serious fighters. No one's making them fight. All right, let's keep looking. Keep this here. He divided his forces against them by night, and he and his servants attacked them and pursued them as far as Hobah, which is north of Damascus. We've looked at this before. It's probably about 60 miles that Abram, at least, over very difficult terrain, that 318 guys are chasing four kings. Of course, it's a little bit harder for the kings to move. They're carrying all their plunder. They're carrying all their slaves. It'd be hard to do. But 318 guys, okay? So he brought back all the goods, and he also brought back his brother Lot and his goods, as well as the women and people. Now, does Abram, is he out for plunder? Is he out for any of this stuff, stealing, general destruction, any of this? None whatsoever. Now, let's see what happens when Abram gets home. Because this is important in this kingdom-building point that we're trying to make here. And the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Sheba, that is a king's valley, after his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him. Abram defeated him. Because he comes back home. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, or king of peace, brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of God Most High. And he blessed him and he said, "Blessed be Abram, God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." So we have Abram definitely submitting to God here through Melchizedek. And he gave him a tithe of all. Now the king of Sodom said to Abram, "Give us the persons and take the goods for yourself." But Abram said to the king of Sodom, "I have raised my hand to the Lord God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I will take nothing from a thread to a sandal strap, that I will not take anything that is yours, lest you should say, I have made Abram rich, except only what the young men have eaten, and the portion of the men who went with me, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre, let them take their portion." Let's see. Voluntary. Is Abram restoring life here? Yeah, you bet he is. No question about it. Is he giving here? Yeah. He and his 318 servants stepped up into a very dangerous situation. What they get out of it, we'll talk about that in a minute. We just heard it. General restoration. Ah, Christ is a great king, and he will restore things to the way they're supposed to be. We see it beginning all the way back here in Genesis. All the way back here. Abram, the restorer. Not the plunderer. The restorer. Submits to God. Is all about the reward for the responsible. He says there at the end, I mean, that would have been, come on, think about it. How easy would that have been? We just read it, we go on to the next chapter, right? Okay, king of Sodom comes out. The 318 servants who'd risk their necks. All this plunder, and the king of Sodom says, you can have it all. I mean, come on. Put yourself in Abram's position here. I mean, aren't you thinking just this much? Like, yeah, maybe just a little bit. Nope, not Abram. Why is that? Look at this. See what Melchizedek said to him? I'll read it again. This is Melchizedek blessing Abram, said, "Blessed be Abraham of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth." Who needs a little sodomite plunder when you're already possessor of heaven and earth? You see, Abraham is actually a king. And he's met by a king and a priest. And that's really what we want to emphasize a little bit as well. Because whenever we talk about kingly activities and societal activities, we must remember that our God is a king and a priest. It's not just about power, king. It's also about righteousness, priest. Now, those two distinctions aren't, we really can't separate them out entirely. But it's interesting to me that Abram gets back and he's met by a man who is both a king and a priest. And throughout the scriptures, we see in godly times, we see the priests informing the kings about their responsibility, do we not? All the time we see this. Of course, we have a Church of Jesus Christ today who believes that informing the civil magistrate is like the last thing they should ever do, because that's giving up the gospel. You know what? You don't want to inform the civil magistrate? pretty soon you won't even have the freedom to preach the gospel anymore. You don't think that's happening to us right now? Right now? Throughout this nation? Our opportunities to share the gospel are getting smaller and smaller, my friends. But we're all about the gospel, and we're not going to inform the civil magistrate what his responsibility is, because we're too spiritual for that. Do you ever think about the fact that Melchizedek doesn't meet Abram any other time? All the wonderful spiritual good things that Abram did. Remember when he prayed for Sodom? Remember that? Melchizedek meets him here. Why? Because Christ is a king, and Abram just rolled back the wicked. Abram just Psalm 9'd those kings. If I can make a verb out of a noun. What do we learn here? The so-called good intentions do not necessarily lead to good results. In fact, outside of Christ, we can only get the opposite. You have a Christless civil magistrate, a godless civil magistrate with all his good intentions. Guess what? By the time he's done, it's going to be worse. Secondly, there's no reason to set up more nations that, like the wicked, will be turned into hell. Thirdly, the worst thing we can do for our neighbor is to build a godless nation. The best we can do is to build the kingdom of Christ. Let me see if I can illustrate here as we wrap up. Anybody recognize this painting? I wouldn't expect you to necessarily. The pitchfork peasants with their pitchforks and their ox goads, it looks like, and perhaps their torches. Now this is a painting from that grand time in history, the French Revolution. You know, liberty, equality, fraternity. What can be wrong with that? Everybody's happy. By the way, I was way out of school when I learned the rest of that slogan. I always thought it was liberty, fraternity, equality. You know, freedom, brotherhood, equality, fraternity there. Anybody know, the rest of that slogan? Somebody here, I bet you knows it. It was liberty, fraternity, equality, or death. They didn't teach me that when I was studying this in high school, or even the Christian college that I went to. And if you know anything about the French Revolution, they were pretty short on liberty. They were pretty short on equality. They were really short on fraternity. But they weren't too short on death. Listen to this description from Adam Zamoyski, written this book called Holy Madness. And basically the book is all about those who get all fired up about nation building and changing the world. He talks about the French Revolution. He says the belief system reigning in Paris at the time of the French Revolution was imposed indiscriminately. Wherever the French armies went in the 1790s, they chased the ruling class from their palaces and their offices, dissolved religious orders, and confiscated their estates, and set up institutions modeled on those of France. Of the 29 constitutions adopted in Europe in the decade between 1791 and 1802, let's see, that'd be about 11 years, 29 constitutions, all but three, one Polish and two Swiss, were a consequence of French military intervention. In effect, the period between Vlamy and Waterloo witnessed a semi-conscious attempt to assert France as the modern Rome and to impose her civilization on the continent. Sound a little bit like nation building to you? It does to me. In trying to reestablish the Roman Empire with his own coronation in 1804, his dissolution of the Holy Roman Empire 2 years later, and his imposition of the Code of Napoleon over the continent, Napoleon was merely building on what Rome had done before. Now, what I just read there, confiscation, you know, chasing people out, dissolving religious orders and so forth, does that sound a little bit like our four kings, or our five kings, if you will, four kings that we just read about in Genesis? Now, how'd they do it? How did the French take over these small duchies in some cases, nations in others? Well, Adam Zamoyski gives us a little bit of a insight. The process was accompanied by rapine and pillage. One of the novelties of the mobile volunteer armies of revolutionary France was that they were sent out on campaign without even basic provisions and therefore foraged for food wherever they could. The quartermasters paid for this, if at all, in largely worthless paper bills. Behind the armies, the specially appointed agencies, evacuation and later other commissions, put method into the looting of works of art, looting books, manuscripts, models, scientific instruments and drawings, collection of everything from herbs to minerals and even machinery. This spoliation was entirely in tune with the Roman concept of continuous enrichment of the imperial metropolis, a process justified by its being the capital of the universe from which benefits flowed back equally to all the provinces. And now we're getting to the point of it, are we not? If we have so much virtue, why not spread it around? Isn't that at the heart of nation building, my friends? We're virtuous, they're not, let's spread it. And we spread it by bombs, we spread it by murder, we spread it by lies, we spread it by worse things. In the end, they managed to lop off the head of their king. And he was said to be a tyrant, but he was replaced by hundreds of tyrants, which they elected themselves very directly. So instead of having one tyrant, they had hundreds by the time they were done. But they were all about nation building, and they were all about knowing exactly how to spread their virtue to the entire world. On the other hand, this is a painting. Oliver Cromwell and the secretary John Milton receiving a deputation seeking aid for the Savoy Protestants. And we'll end with this. Try to draw a distinction between kingdom building and nation building, the kingdom of Christ versus the nation of man. In May 1655, the Catholic Duke of Savoy unleashed a vicious persecution against the Protestant Huguenots in the Vaudois, or Waldenses Valley. Newspapers in England reported, a devilish crew of priests and Jesuits leading unspeakable atrocities against their Protestant brethren. Oliver Cromwell immediately sent an agent to the scene whose report verified the persecution. The Lord Protector, Cromwell, headed a subscription list that raised several hundred thousand pounds for the relief of the Waldensian victims. He then brought pressure to bear upon the Duke to stop the campaign. The threat of mobilizing English Navy and the new model army quickly sobered the Duke of Savoy, and the Waldensians survive to this day. That's from Dr. Peter Hammond. That's just a short description. Many of you know about that. I want to read for you the letter that Cromwell sent to King Louis. And if there's ever a carrot and stick approach, it's definitely here. It is said that John Milton actually penned it, so we don't know how much John Milton had to do with the actual wording and how much Cromwell did. Here it is, May 25th. The groans of the unhappy Protestants who inhabit Luzerne, Auvergne, and other Alpine valleys within the dominions of the Duke of Savoy have reached our ears. And the lamentable tidings of the bloody massacres which decimated them and the spoliation of banishment of the survivors have constrained us to write this letter to your majesty, more particularly as it has been reported to us, with what truth has not yet been ascertained, that part of your majesty's troops joined with those of the Duke of Savoy in this carnage. If you know anything about Oliver Cromwell, he didn't lose too many battles. And when he turned the new model army loose, they usually came back victorious. And he had, by this time, built up the English Navy, which was quite a feat because up until this point, Spain had pretty much ruled the waves. Pretty much. But the English navy under Cromwell is in the ascendance. So he's saying, we've heard about this, Your Majesty. We have not, however, lightly believed this rumor, for such conduct appears to us neither consistent with good government nor in accordance with the practices of Your Majesty's ancestors, who always esteemed it their interest for the peace of their own kingdom as well as for that of all Christendom to permit their subjects of the Reformed religion to live secure from violence and attacks under their authority and protection. And this clemency, it is which has often gained the kings of France the useful and glorious support of their Protestant subjects, both in peace and war. Can you see the stick slowly emerging? Such an example persuaded the Dukes of Savoy to treat with similar benignity, or benignly, if you will, the inhabitants of the Alpine valleys, who in return were very submissive to their princes and never stinted either life or fortune in their service. We do not doubt but that the alliance of Your Majesty with the present Duke of Savoy and the influence which your words must have with him will enable you to obtain for these unfortunate creatures, by your intervention and your expression of goodwill, peace and permission to return to their homes and the restoration of their former liberty. It will be an action worthy of Your Majesty and in accord with the wise examples of your most serene ancestors. And not only will those of your subjects who profess the Reformed religion be thereby greatly confirmed in the belief that they have no such persecution to apprehend, but also, now the stick is a little more visible here, but also the Protestant allies and confederates of Your Majesty will thereafter be bound to you by the stronger ties of fidelity and friendship. For ourselves, all that Your Majesty may grant in this respect to your own subjects or may obtain by your intervention for the subjects of other powers will rank in our gratitude equally and far above all the other great and numerous advantages that we promise ourselves from Your Majesty's friendship. I hope you got that. Oliver Cromwell's doing what Abram did, only he's doing it with a letter. Stop the killing. You know what happened in history? King Louis, he got the message. He read the letter and he saw what it was really saying. He knew what Cromwell was saying. Stop persecuting the Protestants, or we'll help you stop it. And wisdom became the better part of valor there. Do you see the difference? My friends, for nation building for the wicked, burning, slavery, torture, death is not the problem. It's the solution. And for kingdom building, for the kingdom of Christ, putting a stop to that and promoting the glorious gospel of Jesus Christ, that's the real solution. Questions tonight about what we said. Yes, Ed.
Joel, can you?
Oh, so, thank you. Sorry about that. Oh. Yeah, the camera will pick it up. There you go. Excellent.
Joel, can you apply what you discussed tonight a little bit to the current situation in the world today and how you could put this this plan into practice.
The plan into practice.
Well, no more nation building.
Right, right, exactly. Many of you probably have had the opportunity to study Washington's farewell address, in which he urged the colonies, as they were then, well, actually, I guess they were states by that time, really, because he was president, to stay out of events, if you will, not belonging to them. Now, this would have to start on two levels. I've thought about this a little bit. It has to start certainly with those who are, quote-unquote, in power, But that's not where it really begins. It must begin in the pulpits of the land. It must. Read a book recently. Some of you may have seen it. It was actually written in 1924 by a doctoral student. And it was what it was about. I can't recall the name of it. American Vision actually sells it. What it was about, they called it the Puritan pulpit or the New England pulpit and the war for independence. And what amazed me about the book, I never really realized this before. I never really realized, we tend to think that our founding fathers, if you will, the Jeffersons and the Madisons, even the Washingtons and so forth, Adamses, of course, were the ones to hammer out the principles of freedom. Now, principles of freedom, of course, are always difficult because there are those that don't understand it, because some people will say, well, freedom and chaos are the same thing. And every time you turn back chaos, you're turning back freedom. Someone's freedom to kill his neighbor, for Pete's sake. So how do you hammer that out? Well, it turns out, and that book really made the point, that prior to the Adamses and the Jeffersons and the Madisons hammering them out, you know what I'm going to say? These principles were hammered out in the pulpits of New England again and again, and letters back and forth, and trying to deal with that exact question. How does this work? It is time. Our politicians are not going to get it at all. It is time for the pastors once again to begin to speak to these issues. And if they don't, we're going to keep on getting what we are getting. And the pastors in our nation, shame on us, great shame, have made it now a virtue not to speak of these things. It's now virtuous. That's where it has to. It must start there. We the people cannot go straight to the politicians. They know how to schmooze us. They do fear, and we see this throughout the scriptures. The kings didn't. I mean, there were kings who didn't fear armies, for Pete's sake. But you read the Bible, Old Testament and New Testament, John the Baptist. There was one thing that kings did fear: a gutsy prophet who feared God more than them. The kings feared them. It's got to start with the pastors, who fear God more than anything else.
Did you ever hear of the Black Robe Regiment?
Yeah, we actually had a presentation on those, and they were godly men. They were, and what I certainly love about the Black Robe Regiment was they didn't just urge everybody else to get out there and fight. They put it out there themselves because they believed in what they were doing. A lot more could be said about that. Randy.
Yeah, a question. Is this on? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Abraham went after the four kings.
Yes.
The four kings didn't attack him. Why did he do that? That wasn't defensive. He didn't have to go after those four kings.
Yeah. But he was about peace.
Yeah. And
restoration.
That's a real, you know, you get into emotions, you get into the whys and the what fors, but that gets real, real, real touchy, I think.
It could, but I think a careful reading of it, a careful understanding of the purpose of shall we say, armed conflict. What is the purpose of armed conflict? Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
But here, I want to talk about how we explain this, or how we should explain it. Do we carry a gun, for example, so that we can go out and shoot people? No, of course not. Many people carry guns and never shoot anyone in their entire lives. This happens all the time. But why do we carry a gun? But yeah, because we want to stop people from shooting people. That's why. And that's where Abram is right here. Abram, you know, I read this, and I think, you know, he's met by Melchizedek. And Abram would have been the absolute talk of the region. Everybody would have known this. And I can't help but believe that anybody who was thinking of messing at least with Abram Okay, if other people are plundering each other, they didn't take Lot. Okay, that's one thing. But around Abram, I'm thinking there had to have been peace for quite a long time. And a lot of peace. And if you wanted peace, guess who you'd be lined up with? And the Bible doesn't say it, but my guess is that after this happened, he had a whole lot more than 318 trained servants. The Bible didn't say it. But the man was a man of peace. As we see, he was met by the King of Peace. Good questions. Yes. Other.
So I couldn't agree with you more that this has to start coming from the pulpits. But at the same time, are there inroads being made because of social media, because of, you know,
yes,
groups there? And
yes,
I mean,
there
I've
are.
Certainly learned from that.
Yes, there certainly are. And some of the inroads being made, I believe, are the, shall I say, unmasking of the institutional church. That's something that the inroads being made. The institutional church is absolutely part of the problem here. The institutional church is, they're court prophets. I mean, we see court prophets all throughout the Old Testament. And I think social media, if it's not doing anything else, and there is some good things happening there, very good things. But I believe people are starting to see through the institutional church. I think social media is actually a huge part of that. I know, even before social media got so big, I mean, I knew folks who just would say things like, you know, I went to my pastor. I had just some of the most simple questions about society. And just told me to shut up. I think I mentioned to some of you, some of you know, one of the leaders in our church, Seth Brown, we had a discussion here last week, and, you know, if you know about our church, the Independence Reformed Bible Church, Seth did a presentation on the shack by Paul Young. And some people were interested in it because it went on, thanks to the work here of Dean and his family, it got on YouTube, as all these presentations do. And someone in California wanted it and wanted to share it with her church. And Seth told me about this. Guess what was the first thing Seth and I talked about after he told me this young lady wanted it? First thing we talked about was, hope she's ready to find a new church. That's the first thing we said. Ah, Seth got a call. Bow. 4 weeks later, you're out. You're out. Not surprising at all. I'll tell you what, you ask some questions of your pastor, some basic, simple questions, not just the shack. Questions like this, and I heard Pastor Jason Garwood talking about this recently, and he made the comment, and this is, again, social media because it's Reconstruction Radio, so it's social media. And Jason Garwood made the case. He said, look, he said, people say you're giving up the gospel. He said, you mean to tell me that in all the 66 books, verse after verse, there's nothing in there about politics and society? Are you serious? And the answer from our institutional church is yes. There's nothing in there about politics. Nothing in there about society. Nothing in there about nations. No wonder we're in such a mess. We've taken the sword of the Spirit, the all 66 books, we've turned it into a penknife. A butter knife, for Pete's sake. Yes. You'll need the mic. Oh. Okay, right. You'll need the mic. Yeah, right over here to your left, Randy. Thanks. Thank you.
I think one time you did a presentation and you explained that the institution pastors, a survey was taken of pastors of institutional churches, and they said yes, that they believed the Bible did address these things, but they did not teach it to their congregation. You did. That was one topic.
Yes, it was.
You presented one time, or information you presented one time. But I had always heard that Abraham went after the captives who were taken because Lot and his family were in that group.
Yeah, and they were.
That was the initial motivation for him to go after, and maybe he was going to plan to extract only his family and their goods, but he ended up saving the whole city and all the captives who were taken from the cities.
Yeah, I've heard that as well. I'm sorry, go ahead. You can finish. I'm sorry.
Which leads into my statement or question.
Okay.
Doesn't God's law not support offensive nation building, to take nations just for the sake of building broadly, and land taking? But as you build a godly nation, nations will come to you because you will have the authority and the power as you obey God's law throughout the nation, and you make laws based on God's law. You will become not a borrower. You will never need to borrow, but nations will borrow from you, which will give you more and more power to have influence for God's law over neighboring nations, and all the blessings will affect the nations around you. But it is a defensive, God's law is, nation building is defensive only, not offensive, for the sake of building onto your nation.
Right. In other words, and that is correct. We've seen that in history under Cromwell. We've seen it under King Alfred. We saw it in this country for a long time, a godly nation. I mean, think of a nation that's so great that people will leave everything they have, even their families, to come here. That's somewhat unprecedented. I mean, I'm not a history of civilization guru necessarily, but you just don't see that happening too often. In fact, Bo Marinoff argues that prior to Moses, there was no such animal as the rule of law. It didn't exist. Hammurabi's code came afterwards, not before, when we understand proper chronology here. And back then, when you left your country, you could expect to be killed. We see that with Cain. Remember that? He said, I'm leaving my country. Everybody is going to want to kill me here. But it was only God's law that set it up so that the stranger could come and live under the protection. So in building the kingdom, we don't build other nations. We protect godly nations. And Deuteronomy 4 shows us that the other folks will see around will see this godliness and want what they have there. Deuteronomy 4 definitely makes that case. We don't have to go and conquer people and kill them and carry them off into slavery and so forth. How about if we take care of business at home? Worry about godliness at home. And then we'll see what God does with everyone else. Right now in this country, I'm afraid, we're all about worrying about almost every corner of the earth. Meanwhile, we got 60 million dead babies here. Kind of hard to make the case that we're all about life. Kind of hard to make that case. Randy.
Yeah, I don't think it's a... Let me try to phrase it correctly. I don't think it's the pastors and the church anymore, although it was. It is now the people sitting in the pews.
Okay, yeah.
And it's deteriorated that much because the pastors and the church denomination would do what the people that are putting the money in the basket say to do. And they're not saying it. They want that fluff and puff and tickle my ears.
Yeah, Randy, no question. It's a definite symbiotic relationship. This is not parasite host. This is, for the most part, this is symbiosis. Definitely.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah, we do. But it's not a problem that hasn't been seen before. That's the key. That's the biggie. We've seen this before. You know, it's interesting, just a second, John. I grew up thinking that the communists were the only one who punished people for reading the Bible. That's how I grew up. Just totally not true. That's been happening all the time. Yes, John.
Question about nations.
Yes.
As history progresses, will nations merge one into another, or will they simply live in peace as they become more and more Christian? It's an argument that the Kinists make. And it just, you know, it seems to be part of this conversation.
Right. I think we have some help here on a couple points. One is the statement, Isaiah, nations shall not lift up sword against nation, which sounds like you still have national boundaries going on there. But the other part of it is Cromwell's England. He engineered peace between nations. Now, they didn't become England, but he engineered peace between them. The Danes, for example, and the Dutch as well. It's not well known, but Cromwell got himself in a lot of trouble with the... it's going to sound a little stereotypical here, but it's history, so we'll talk about it. Cromwell got himself in a lot of trouble with the London merchants. And because what he did, he opened up England again to Jews. It was illegal to be a Jew in England from about the 13th century on until the time of Cromwell. And Cromwell opened it back up again. Now, it wasn't because he believed in the Jewish religion, but he felt that they should be able to come and live in England as long as they didn't, as he would say, meddle with the consciences of those of others. And he entertained in the hall there at Westminster a Jewish merchant, a well-known Jewish merchant. Now, how do you think that sat with the existing London merchants? Not well. So, I mean, he was... Through the strength of his, of a godly man with an army and a navy to back him up, in history we have seen peace engineered between nations. How it'll look at the end, I can't tell you. But we do know what's happened in the past. All right. Well, hey, thank you for your questions tonight and your excellent attention. Kind of a long presentation tonight.